Hello from Midori House in London. Welcome to Sunday Brunch. I'm Paul Osborne. Coming up today, why are luxury brands working with artists and what are they hoping to get out of it? Also,
I grew up in a house full of classical music recordings and art books. And in retrospect, coming to the end of a cello career, I thought, you know what? I never listened to classical music when I was in that house as a kid. I was always with my head in the art books.
Roger Holton tells us how he went from prominent cellist to abstract artist. We'll hear how London's best Indian chefs are coming together to celebrate an anniversary, and
I took the idea of Around the World in 80 Days by Jules Verne, starting out in London, then generally going eastwards until we're back in London again.
We'll go around the world via interesting trees. All that, plus a look through the weekend's papers, all coming up in the next hour on Sunday Brunch, live from London on Monocle 24. So hello, welcome to today's Sunday Brunch. Later in the programme, of course, we'll take a full look through the weekend's papers. Words from the front pages include bombshell poll and dirty dossier, so there'll be plenty to get through there. Let's begin, however, by exploring the growing association between art and luxury brands. Many are developing partnerships with artists, and we want to talk about why that is. Last year in Rome, Fendi hosted an exhibition by the Italian artist Giuseppe Pannoni. And this week, the London department store Fortnum & Mason is launching an exhibition of works by the British landscape artist John Virtue. Now, with me in the studio is the art collector Frank Cohen, who's collaborated with the store on that exhibition, and Ziad Sarim Slade is the customer experience director of Fortnum & Mason. To begin with, just tell me a little bit about this exhibition. Where did the idea come from?
Fortnum's and Frank was an idea conceived by Ewan Venters, the CEO of Fortnum's, and Frank Cohen, the art collector, who's here with us today, 3 years ago. So Frank is quite a formidable character, and he met Ewan socially, and Frank was wandering through the store and challenged Ewan on the art collection that we have in the store currently. That art collection has been born over a number of years and is obviously very fitting of the space of Fortnum's. But rightly so, Frank challenged on us on showing more contemporary and modern British art, and wouldn't it be exciting? And from that kind of seed that was sown, Fortnum's and Frank was born, as it were. And in year one, we showed over 60 pieces of Frank's work from artists from Tracy Emin, Leon Kossoff, Howard Hodgkin, and it was a formidable show, really disruptive and challenging to the environment of Fortnum & Mason, which was fantastic. Because that was so well received, we then went on to year two, where we showed the work of John Bellany, the Scottish artist. And of course, this is year three, where we're showing John Virtue, which we're very excited about. And the installation went on last night, so we've seen some pics hot off the press of the store as it comes to life.
Frank, so tell me a little bit about John Virtue, for people who don't know him.
He's a brilliant artist. He went to the Slade School of Art. He was his tutor was Frank Auerbach and Ewan Uglow. He works in monochrome, only black and white. He has been working for about 30, 40 years all over the world. He worked in Tuscany. He's worked in England. He's now working in Norfolk. And also he was an artist in residence at the National Portrait Gallery, the National Gallery. And he is very influenced by the landscape British artist, you know, Turner, but only he worked in colours and John works in black and white. He gets up every morning, very, very, very early, and in Norfolk walks the seashore and takes drawings, small drawings, pieces them all together, maybe 60 or 70, on one piece of art, and then he paints them or covers them in something called shellac, which is like an egg yolk. And it's a very, very time-consuming and very monotonous sort of way that he's worked all his life. I first saw him in Bernard Jacobson Gallery many years ago, and he's been exhibiting in the Marlborough Gallery, and he went to Lisson Gallery. Now he's with Albion Barn. And I do believe he's one of these artists that now needs the exposure because he has been overlooked over the years, where he is a fantastic technician of the work that he does. He paints and oils as well, and he does seascapes. And you look at them and they come to life. And to be honest with you, you go back and look at them again and again and again. And that I mean, you can't really stop looking at them. And it's a very, very, very interesting artist.
You mentioned a minute ago, so that the idea came from you used to saying, well, why aren't you showing more contemporary works? You've got this art that you exhibit within the store. Why not show something more contemporary? That's quite disruptive, though, isn't it? It's more disruptive. For people, I should take a step back. For people who don't know Fortnum & Mason, haven't been in it, describe it for me.
Well, I'll explain. It's very, very... It's unusual for anyone to have an art exhibition in a departmental store. I think I'm the only person on earth that's ever done this. And to be honest with you, people go to galleries and they look in galleries, they go to museums, but to do something like this is a bit off the wall, really, in a way, because remember one thing: Fortnum & Mason's has got suites on the ground floor, you've got groceries on the lower ground floor, you've got fashion on another floor, and to integrate it with art is a very, very clever idea. And when I originally spoke to Ewan Venters, the chief executive, I said, are you sure that you want to do this, Ewan? He says, yeah. And I pulled it off, and between us, we pulled this thing off, and it's a wonderful experience for people to walk around the store and see artworks that maybe these people would never go into galleries, never go into museums, a different sort of clientele that are not collectors, and see these things. And the letters and the write-ups and the texts and the emails that we get after the show is unbelievable.
I think what's also worth adding is, like, there's a real sense of domesticity to Fortnum's. It's unlike many other stores where you walk in, there's carpet, there's chandeliers. So it is a quite a domestic setting. And the art collection that we have throughout the year, we don't feel we're exhibiting it. It's there. It's part of the fabric of the experience of Fortnum's. And many of the pieces, you know, Garfield Weston back in the 1950s used to pop out for lunch, and St. James's and Piccadilly is obviously rife with galleries. And it wasn't unusual for him to come wandering in with a big painting under his arm that he'd picked up that he liked, and just say to someone, you know, put that on the third floor. I think people will enjoy it there. So we never really think of that collection as being an exhibit, as it were. So really the first undertaking of Fortnum's and Frank, it was a completely different mindset. It was about disrupting people. It was about being provocative. It was about Fortnum's having a point of view on and sharing and making accessible this work. And we love the fact that you're seeing it in a context that's completely different. Seeing a Frank Auerbach next to the Biscuits, or the eight windows of Piccadilly facing the Royal Academy, showing these amazing works of art, it's a provocation. It gives people something else to enjoy, and shows that we are of today, really.
Now, it's not just Fortnum's that do this. We mentioned Fendi at the beginning of the introduction. Rolls-Royce has a big art project. But there is a thread here of what you might term sort of luxury brands partnering with artists. And so you inevitably say, is this an extension of the old-fashioned philanthropy of big businesses who decide to give some money to support the arts? Or is it a more strategic thing, that there's a thought process of, this is good PR for us to be seen to be supporting the artistic community? It will bring in more customers through the doors. Yeah. It will sell more goods.
I think for us, there's definitely a mix of both of those things. I think, you know, Fortnum's has a long, long, long history of supporting the arts and culture in this country. And if you think about it, design and art is at the heart of kind of what we do. So making amazing product and then putting them in packaging that is desirable, that people want to keep, means we've worked with a lot of artists over the years. And if you look at our long history of working with, you know, the likes of Edward Ball, who's got an exhibition on down at the Dulwich Picture Gallery at the moment, it's intrinsic to the way we operate. obviously, as you come, as times change and you see what goes on in the world and you're looking at where your audiences are and what people are interested in, you know, nowadays more than ever, we hear people talk about people want experience, people want to learn, people want to buy into culture. It's not about things and material goods. So it makes sense that something that we do intrinsically is given a slightly reframed way of being. And that's what I think we've done with Fortnum's and Frank. We've always loved art. We've always supported artists. We've always worked with different colleges, different individuals. But this gives a different type of context. And obviously, it shouldn't be lost on anyone that we do it over the period where Frieze is in town, you know, when the kind of global art world descends on London, because it's about being relevant to those audiences. But it's not... for us, it's definitely not a cold, calculated decision. It's just, it's kind of more fortuitous than that.
And also, remember, all the artists now work with brands. I mean, you've got Louis Vuitton works with brands. You've got Damien Hirst works with brands. You've got Murakami who works with brands. You've got Nara who works with brands. Joseph Albers was doing scarves for Hermes. I mean, this is Victoria Beckham was photographed in a boutique in Dover Street recently with Rubens and paintings.
Well, I was going to say, how different is this? If you go to any sort of major gallery, you will see a long list of corporate sponsors, or you will see that the gallery is owned by one particular wealthy benefactor who keeps it going. Is this just a new way or a different way of achieving the same end?
No, but I'll tell you what it's in. 90% of the art of the fashion buyers or that buy the fashion are collect art today, whereas they never did years and years ago. So now they've integrated with these artists, which gives them a different platform, and people are mad, as you can imagine, all over the world. So, you know, you get Barney's doing in New York doing displays with artists within the store. And I think that the generation has changed. And if you go round the art fairs, and you'll see that the artists are making jewellery. So all the art collectors are buying jewellery, you know, affiliated to the actual artist, whoever it is. Damien Hirst is done that many objects and plates and things and towels, and they're attracted to it, and I think it gives them a bigger audience as well. And I think, to be honest with you, these people, that it increases their turnover in a tremendous way. By, you know, say, for example, Louis Vuitton with the Murakami handbag. I mean, that was a massive big seller. And everyone wanted to walk. Anyone that was collecting art or anyone that was in the art world, and even people then saw them in the street. And if they weren't collectors, they would still go in and buy a Louis Vuitton Murakami handbag. So I think it's just a way of promoting business and getting extra revenue coming into the stores.
Is it something, when you said this is the third year of doing this, is when you're looking for artists to feature, you're thinking about works to feature, you've got in the back of your head that this is not the same setting as a gallery where things are laid out in a sort of quiet, peaceful way. As you say, you know, I've been in and out of Fortnum & Mason. I've lived in London for 20-odd years. It sounds awful. I'd never noticed that there were large, you know, artworks being displayed in the store.
Yeah.
But this is a much more disruptive thing. You've got that in the back of your mind.
Yes, I know. But you've got to be very careful, because what you show and what you don't show in the store, really, because it is a store for the public, and children are going in and parents are going in. It's a family store. So you can't really put sort of things that they... some things that they show in public museums that, you know, are ex certificates, which a lot of the artists do, a lot of ex certificate artworks. But the content, there's a quite a difference between the contemporary art market and the modern British art market. And John Virtue stands in between modern British and contemporary, because he does big canvases. But all the contemporary artists like Damien Hirst, Jeff Koons, David Sally, you know, those type of artists wouldn't be, they wouldn't really, you would find it difficult to put an exhibition on in the store of those artists, because, you know, the dealers are very close-knit with the dealers, and they want to control them. Whereas in my collection, I've got a massive collection of 2,000 pieces of artists that a lot of them are dead, and these are modern bitches, and they think in a different way. And in fact, I think the store lends itself to the type of thing that we're doing in there.
I think the other point on that is it's no surprise that you would come in the store and not notice, because it comes back to the point of domesticity. So obviously the placement of those artworks that we normally have all year round are, you know, it's part of the materiality of the store, whereas the purpose of what we do with Fortnum's and Frank is to provoke. So when you take John Virtue's work, for example, and I went first up to Albion Barn to have a look as we were beginning to work out what we were going to do this year, the scale is immense. And it's kind of almost uncomfortable in some of the context of the store. And then also when you think of Fortnum's and you think of colour and sparkle, John's work is monochromatic. So those juxtapositions are quite powerful, which would mean, I find it very surprising if anyone could walk in the store over the coming month and not notice. And that's what we want. I remember when we very first sat down around the table to talk about the potential for this collaboration, and someone said, well, we need to be very, very careful that people aren't made uncomfortable. And for me, that was absolutely not what we wanted. You know, I wanted people to come in and see things that they weren't expecting to see, because otherwise, what's the point? It's a huge undertaking to bring in, you know, last night, 65 large scale pieces of art and take art out of till points and staircases and take the windows over on Piccadilly. It's a huge undertaking. So if we're going to go to that effort, then it needs to have a strong point of view, and it needs to make people stop and think. We're not asking you to enjoy every piece of work at all, but we don't want you to walk past it and be like, that was a tea clipper, which is normally what we have in that environment. I think it's also fair to say that part of the reason why the collaboration is so interesting is, you know, Frank's background is as a retailer. Mm. So actually there's a real authenticity to the meeting of those minds, and the fact that we're not in a gallery setting, and we all value that as part of the story.
We'll have to leave it there. Those works are on display from tomorrow until the 20th of October at Fortnum & Mason in London. Ziad Zirimslade, Frank Cohen, thank you both very much for coming in this morning. In just a moment, we will meet a man who has exchanged the cello for the paintbrush.
See that man sitting opposite you on the subway, lost in another world? Or that smart woman scribbling notes while having her flat white? Well, here's what links them. They're both listening to Monocle 24 via our free radio app that simply and seamlessly lets you tune in live or download shows for later enjoyment. Just think, you too could be settling back enjoying cultural nourishment in the form of the Monocle Arts Review, being briefed on the world of business with the entrepreneurs, or just enjoying great music with the sessions at Midori House. Come on, download the Monocle 24 app today, stick on your headphones, and have informed fun on the go. Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Well, next, Roger Holtom, someone you would think has it all at the peak of his career as a concert cellist, having dedicated much of his life to the instrument. He then gave it all up for a different type of art, a little more abstract. He creates explosions of colour by standing above a canvas and flicking, smearing and pouring different coloured paints. All this while still playing a piece of music by Bach every day. He spoke to Monocle's Henry Rhys Sheridan.
My mother was an amateur violinist and did all she could to get me the best lessons that were available and made me into the potential for a professional cellist, which I enjoyed.
And you went through the whole conservatoire system?
I actually bypassed it. I did a music degree specialising in cello performance, but my college equivalent was actually on the job, really. I migrated to Australia at 30, was lucky enough to get taken into a string trio, which is a violin, viola and cello. And the violinist was a guy called Bob Ingram, who was the concertmaster of the opera orchestra, for goodness sake. And Cesca Barre, the principal viola of the symphony. So I was right with the cream of the crop. And they pulled me up from the level where I was and made me a professional, let's say. Yeah.
So I think we're going to go on to discuss the connection between your music and your visual art and the transition between. But before we do that, I actually want to hear some of your cello playing. We have some to play. What piece are we going to hear?
In the late 90s, I worked a lot with a Japanese girl called Ota Meiaoi, and we did a duo recitals, largely in London. And we recorded the Beethoven A major sonata for cello and piano, which is particularly gorgeous because it's very much a duet. It's not a cello with accompaniment, it's a duet. And her piano playing shines at least as much as my cello playing. The most gorgeous part for me is the third movement, which is very brief, unusually brief, and just very beautiful.
So, Roger, when and how did you begin to make the transition from music to visual art?
It was right there in Australia. I played every day with these guys in the Intercontinental Hotel, which is a beautiful building. They made a glass structure over the courtyard, and we played whilst people drank their tea. The string trio repertoire is superb. We played regularly the Mozart Divertimento for string trio, which is very difficult, and just astonishingly beautiful. It's the most, probably my favourite piece of classical music ever.
And in the midst of that lifestyle, you made the turn towards being a visual artist.
It was right there. I had this well-paid job every day. I was living in a beautiful apartment, and I was sort of twiddling my thumbs a bit the rest of the day. I was playing for 4 hours in the afternoon, and I'd always been interested in painting because my mother was a professionally trained painter. So I'd seen it done. I'd seen it done properly, let's say. And I thought, well, you know what? I'll have a go myself. So in this luxurious situation where I was being fed the beauty of classical music every day and with time to spare, I started experimenting.
You seem to have been very directly influenced then by your mother's activities.
That's true. She was a powerful lady, yeah. What I found interesting, looking back, is that I grew up in a house full of classical music recordings and art books. And in retrospect, coming to the end of a cello career, I thought, you know what? I never listened to classical music when I was in that house as a kid. I was always with my head in the art books. And I thought, well, there you go. Let's take this one by the horns and run with it.
So you're a painter now. Did you start as a painter?
Yes, always as a painter. I tried to do it correctly, let's say, in terms of being a figurative painter, and it just didn't work. And I didn't feel like going through all the hoops you have to go to learn those skills. I'd done that with a cello. So I thought, well, you know what? I'll just do whatever feels good. So I've been doing that for close on 30 years now, and that's in itself is very unusual and gives me a particular angle. I've honed my particular way of doing it.
What similarities and differences are there between the process of making music and the process of making visual art?
What I love about painting is that nobody's dictating to me what I should do. It's me from start to finish. I do it in my way, and I decide if I want to trash it and start again, I can, you know, and it can be completely different. I think the experience of having laboriously learnt the craft of playing the cello has stood me in good stead for having a concept of precision in what I do as a painter. But moment to moment, it's sort of random, really. I just do whatever comes into my head next.
There is a kind of relationship between deliberate process and improvisation in your painting practice. I know that a previous exhibition of yours was called Liberty with Order.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit more about that tension.
Liberty with Order was actually a quote that I took from Pablo Casals, probably the most important cellist we've ever had. It's a beautiful concept. To hone the skills, I said nobody tells me how to do it, but I develop my own particular response to the problems in painting, and they become my technical tools, and that's what I use in an improvised fashion. So the order is there because I've organised what I do, I've studied what I do, and I've practised what I do. Therefore, the order is sort of in me, if you like, which is what Cassell's said about cello playing. It had never really been said before. He talked about the finger ends being like a outreach station from the brain, and it's all so beautifully interconnected that if you train it properly, if you go 10 times, he would say, from there to there, like the extremes of the cello, perhaps, if you can do that perfectly 10 times, it's there. You've just got it. And then the job on performance is to allow yourself to access those things that have been programmed in, rather than blocking it with nervous twitches or awkwardness or muscular tension.
So you've got a new exhibition coming up here in London. Where is it? What is it called? And what can we expect?
It's called Boom, and it's at Fiumana Place in Bloomsbury. You can expect an array of different stuff, really, because it's been an exciting summer. I've been very busy, and I just sort of ran with being busy and with lots of stuff. I live in Italy, and I'm very involved with the local community, and summer gets full on. I just thought, well, you know what? I'll just use whatever time I do have. So I was given a wonderful big space to work in, which has become my studio. I would go in when I had all sorts of other things on my mind, work on a canvas, and then just leave again, probably because I had to. And what has happened is it's much fresher than it used to be, I feel. If I stand there being an artist and working, thinking, and that's the thing, engaging the brain puts a restricted structure on top. I say that my body and my impulses are much purer than anything my brain could come up with in the moment. So if I leave it, something that's happened without me thinking too much about it, I tend to come back and go, wow, you know what, that's fresh and exciting. Whereas if I'd stood there, I would have thought, it's a bit imbalanced to that side. I come back and I think, oh, isn't that wonderful how it's imbalanced to that side? A bit like that.
Before I let you go, I want to ask you about an extremely civilised habit you have. You still play a cello piece by Bach every single day. Tell me about the effect that has on you.
To be honest, it's more and more frustrating because I'm not the cellist I used to be. Once you've done it very well, it's annoying to do it not very well. But Bach is so wonderful, it doesn't matter if it's performed perfectly. It's sort of, in a sense, it never is. It's what it is. It's beautifully constructed musical architecture, and I feel that it subliminally calms me and puts me in touch with something pure, natural. And from there, when I do play, the troubles of the day wash off me.
Roger Holtom speaking to Henry Rhys Sheridan. That exhibition, as he says, called Boom. It's at the Fiumana Place Gallery from the 13th of September until the 19th of October. This is Sunday Brunch from Monocle 24. Time now for our weekend read, when we catch up with a different author about their latest work. This week, it's Jonathan Drury, a trustee of the Eden Project, formerly a trustee of the Royal Botanic Gardens at Kew and the Woodland Trust. He is one of the best placed people to write about trees. And as he explained to Georgina Godwin, he's written a book full of the most fascinating ones, which is called Around the World in 80 Trees.
Not only does it feel great, but I think that the combination of the designers and the producers of the book have made something that is incredibly tactile. There's something about it that makes me want to run my fingers across the images, and there's a sort of smoothness to it that is kind of delectable. I know it sounds like a sort of slightly saucy thing to say, but I can't. It's also slightly odd because it's my own book, so maybe that has something to do with it.
No, I completely get that. And as we speak, I'm actually stroking a picture of the Argan tree with goats in its branches.
Yeah, the comedy goats of Morocco that sit there in the trees munching the Argan fruit. Yeah.
So listen, you've been a huge fan of plant science from a very young age. So tell me how the seeds were planted for you, so to speak.
Ho, ho, ho. My father had originally trained as a botanist and dragged us around the Royal Botanic Gardens, Kew. We lived in Twickenham near Kew in southwest London. And My mother was someone who was really interested in the beauty of trees. So I was brought up with the science and beauty, I think, combined. And in fact, when my mother died, in her purse, she had a botanist's magnifying glass. And I thought right to her dying day, she would look at the beauty of plants.
Mm-hmm. One of the most fascinating parts of this book is finding out how certain trees ended up so far away from their natural habitat. So the London Plane, for instance, is a hybrid from potentially any number of countries.
Yes. I mean, there's a debate about where it actually hybridized, but probably Spain, with its parents coming from the Balkans, but does fantastically well in really polluted cities. And at the height of the empire in the 19th century, this was a terrific tree to have. Actually, the oldest trees that we have of the species are in Berkeley Square, planted in the 17th century.
The book sort of takes us on a journey that the trees aren't written about in isolation. Each one leads on to the next, and they're divided geographically.
Yes, I mean, as a conceit, I took the idea of Around the World in 80 Days by Jules Verne, and starting out in London, then generally going eastwards until we're back in London again.
Mm-hmm. But they each speak to each other, if you like.
Yes, I mean, I suppose there are common themes. You know, so when you mentioned, for example, the hybridisation that caused the London Plain, you know, there are other stories of hybridisation as well and hybrid vigour. So the tree that I chose to represent southern England is the Leylandii, which is a hybrid of two quite unassuming plants from opposite ends of California that met and unfortunately had sex in a garden in Wales in the 19th century. And have this monster child that the British use as a sort of, they've weaponized it, and they use it to plant in a sort of green walls around their properties. It says so much about the British attitude towards privacy and marking territory.
It was very interesting to learn how the avocado tree was likely to have been spread by being ingested by a long extinct giant sloth who would excrete the stone and sow the seeds for a new generation. Now, of course, it relies on humans to disperse the species, and we're doing it quite well. So do you think it's likely that future generations of trees will rely on humans more, possibly thanks to global warming?
Well, I think there are, for centuries, there have been trees that have depended on humans. So the apple tree, for example, which grew up in Kazakhstan and was spread along the Silk Road by human beings, you know, we have for hundreds and hundreds of years selected the varieties that work for us, as opposed to the very, very sour ones that you would get in the wild. So this is nothing new. But I do think that trees will depend more and more on human benevolence because of climate change, because of pests being brought in and out through trade and all the other reasons.
There are wonderful anecdotes in here. You talk about Berlin's lime trees, which intoxicate amorous Germans and bees.
Yes, if you ask Germans where they had their first kiss, they will all say under a lime tree, under a linden tree. Even if it's not true, it's where they had their first kiss, like we have ours behind the bicycle sheds. And the thing that amazes me about Unter den Linden, the street in Berlin that is named after lime trees, is that the Germans, with their sort of, they do like a bit of law and order and so on, and a bit of neatness. And their Mercedes and BMWs are constantly being sort of sullied by this rain of honeydew that lands from the lime trees and gets all sticky and horrible. It's amazing that they put up with it.
Tell me about the Japanese lacquer tree.
A, it's given us the most fantastic artifacts made out of lacquer, which is made from the sap of the tree. But there's also this rather sort of odd and disgusting thing that a particular sect of monks used to do, where they took the lacquer, or at least a sort of the sap from the tree, and made what was called urushi tea. It's very poisonous, and it kind of plasticized them while they were alive. They sort of became living mummies. And the idea was that when they died, emaciated, about a year later, their bodies wouldn't rot. And so when they were dug up after a few years, if the body hadn't been attacked by maggots, then they sort of achieved instant Buddhahood. It was only outlawed, I think, in the end of the 19th century.
Did they die a year or so later as a result of having used it,
though? Yes. it was just a kind of really, really awful, awful thing. In fact, in Japan, there are some shrines where you can go and still see those mummified monks.
Is sap the same as resin?
Not quite. So sap is a sort of common term for the liquid that sort of takes nutrients around the tree. Resin is the stuff that is that really sort of gummy stuff that really doesn't dissolve in water, that if you slash certain kinds of trees, they'll exude resin to try and engulf insects or poison them. So some of the resins that we know well would be things like frankincense, the longest traded luxury good, or the resin from the cedar of Lebanon, for example.
Mm-hmm. And then you have a wonderful bit about resin from New Zealand.
Well, the kauri tree from New Zealand. In the 19th century, these trees were incredibly important because for hundreds of thousands of years, their resin had been accumulating in layers just beneath the surface. And people found that the resin could be used for varnishes and lacquers. And there was, in the same way there was a gold rush to California, there was a resin rush to New Zealand. And the proceeds that the government imposed as tax and so on, those proceeds paid for the whole of the infrastructure of early colonized New Zealand. All the roads and schools and hospitals and things were founded on resin from that kauri tree.
And there's the most brilliant illustration of it in this. I mean, all the illustrations are fantastic.
I think Lucille Clerc, who's a French artist commissioned by the publishers, has done a fantastic job. And, you know, when I first met her, I just wanted to hug her. In fact, I did. Because she's managed to do something which is, I think, completely complementary to the text. And it feels to me like the text and the illustrations are a brother and sister.
Jonathan Drory speaking there to Georgina Godwin. That book, Around the World in 80 Trees, is out now. And of course, at monocle.com, there's a full back catalogue of all the past editions of Meet the Writers. In just a moment, we'll take a look through some of the stories in the weekend's papers.
For a global perspective and some fresh ideas direct to your door on business, culture and design, not to mention fashion, travel and much more, subscribe today and join the world of Monocle. As a valued subscriber, you will get a 10% discount in all Monocle shops and our online store. You'll also be the first to receive exclusive invitations to our events and have full access to the magazine archives. In addition, all one-year subscriptions come with a free limited edition Monocle tote bag. With four bespoke subscription packages to choose from, you decide what suits you and your lifestyle best. What are you waiting for? Visit monocle.com and subscribe today.
Well, it's time to take a look through the weekend's papers. Now, I mentioned at the start of the programme that phrases like dirty dossier and bombshell poll are on the front page of the papers. I'm delighted to say that we're instead heading inside the newspapers to take a look at some other stories with the journalist and broadcaster Juliet Foster. Good morning.
A very good morning to you.
Let's start with a revelation for anyone in Britain that rich people get away with not paying their taxes.
Yes, rich people do get away with paying their taxes. We've always suspected it. And today in Britain, the HM Revenue and Customs Services, HMRC, has admitted it. And appropriately enough, they actually made this admission at an economics crime conference in Cambridge. Now, yes, the basis of what they're telling us is not a surprise. We do know that rich people try to avoid paying their taxes, that some of that money is parked overseas. And of course, it gets moved again when the parking is exposed, notably with the Panama Papers. But what is really quite shocking is that the HMRC has actually said that you've got very, very wealthy individuals, etc., who when they're sort of caught because they're not pulling their weight, they're not contributing as much as they should, in terms of dealing with them, you try to accommodate them. Now, you pay tax, I pay tax, and as far as I'm aware, I have never had an invitation from HMRC saying to me, well, Ms. Foster, why don't you come around to our offices and we'll see how we can accommodate you and how you can accommodate us. And they've actually said that with some of these celebrities and various people, yes, you do get the concessions out of them and they're willing to cut these deals because they don't want the embarrassment of a public trial, to which I think most people would say, well, they should be subjected to a public trial.
That's an easy way to avoid a public trial, isn't it?
Just pay your taxes, exactly. But the hypocrisy is that HMRC will chase after individuals, be they small businesses, whatever, who are not paying their way, rightly so. And of course, if it does go to court and then gets picked up on by the media, it's splashed as a great triumph for the tax gathering authorities in this country. And you will invariably get a statement from somebody from the tax bodies saying whatever, giving their reaction, and then concluding it by saying, you can run, but you can't hide. Beware, we are watching you. I would imagine that if you're sitting on a £500 million fortune, you're probably just saying, yeah, go away. What
planet
do you live on?
You can run, but you can't hide, as long as you can't afford a private jet, in which case you can hide.
Exactly. And really, it's quite a shocking story because, I mean, I mentioned there the Panama Papers. And the expectation was that because of what this investigation had revealed, that we would actually see a lot more people being named and shamed. And in actual fact, in the United Kingdom, the Panama Papers revelations, according to this article, led to 4 arrests and 6 interviews under caution by HMRC. However, broaden out the picture, in Germany, there were 71 prosecutions. In Pakistan, Nawaz Sharif, the former prime minister, he gets sentenced to 10 years in jail. He's fined £8.2 million on corruption charges after his children were linked to offshore companies that owned 4 London flats. In Spain, the tax authorities recovered millions of pounds, often chasing after football players like Cristiano Ronaldo, Lionel Messi. Gets even worse for HMRC because apparently they were asked by French investigators to give them a helping hand because they were looking at money laundering or investigations of money laundering and tax fraud by the telecoms giant Lycomobile. And HMRC refused, citing the fact that the company was, quote, the biggest corporate donor to the Conservative Party, which,
of course, is splendid.
Splendid, absolutely splendid. And initially, HMRC denied the Lycomobile story. And then they later conceded that it was true. The article also has a quote from Prem Sikka, who's a professor of accounting at Sheffield University, and he said, this shows just how far removed the senior leadership of HMRC are from public opinion. This policy provides absolutely no deterrent to tax cheats. It doesn't. And the reason why I chose this story is that we are living in an era when the familiarities of politics that you and I grew up with are being seriously challenged and tilted in directions which none of us really do feel comfortable with. And if you actually trace the route why this is happening, it is because people are very, very cynical of politics and the people who drive political machines, OK? They are very suspicious about different arms of the government body, notably tax, the establishment protecting its own whilst clamping down on ordinary people like you and me, because we are easy to crush. This feeds into that negative narrative.
Well, let's move on from shady people of suspect intent to Vladimir Putin. And no connection at all. And his potential connection to today's elections in Sweden.
Yes, that's right. I mean, these elections are being closely watched because it's not just the way that the political plates will move in Sweden, but it's also Sweden's reputation because it's seen as the great haven of left-wing ideologies and the welcoming climate where those who are oppressed and they're on the run because they're being persecuted can actually go to shelter for sanctuary. They will be warmly received. But of course, the problem is that a lot of Swedish voters or some members of the Swedish electorate feel that perhaps Sweden's reputation for humanity is being taken advantage of, notably by a group of people called migrants, that there are too many of them and that it's stretching resources to the extreme and that they're not contributing. These are items, etc., that we've heard before. But clearly they have been brilliantly exploited by the Swedish Democrats, who are this party who have a rather sort of dodgy roots with neo-Nazis and various others. They now have this new leader who in this article is photographed in Swedish national costume with his girlfriend. He's a gentleman called Jimmy Akerson, and he vehemently denies that the party has got racist and various other nasty individuals. He actually says that they've purged the party of those elements. But clearly the message of and being anti-immigrant, etc., it has actually clicked with the public. So they're basically seen as a party which, even if they're not going to take overall control of the government, they will certainly be the kingmakers between the two centrist blocs. Now, this election is not just being eyed very closely by the West, but also by Vladimir Putin, because the suspicion is that he's been doing what he does best. He's also been meddling in this. So they claim, of course, he would deny this. But there are some serious gains for him to be had, because remember, Putin doesn't like NATO. Russia never has. But especially when you've got former states which were part of the old Warsaw Pact that have joined NATO, that makes them feel a little bit unsettled. Now, Sweden is not a member of the NATO alliance, it has to be stressed, but it supports the group. So, for example, you have got these military exercises, war games, Trident Juncture, which are taking part this month. In fact, next month, in fact. And this brings together America and Britain, OK? And I believe that it's going to happen on Swedish soil or whatever. So normally, the Swedes are quite welcoming. But you've got members of the Swedish Democrats who don't like the idea of Sweden even giving way in some grounds to NATO. You've got people in the party who are very pro-Putin. So Putin likes this. And as I said, there is suspicion that the Kremlin has interfered in these elections, and they try to whip up the fury. So one example, which the paper cites, of this covert Russian backing of the Swedish Democrats, is what happened in the World Cup. Now, I didn't actually see this match. Maybe you did. But there was a lot of media abuse against the Swedish footballer Jimmy Durmaz. Now, he's a midfielder. He's also the son of immigrants. And basically, he committed a foul in the World Cup match against Germany. And that meant that they had to give away a free kick to the Germans. And that cost Sweden the match. There was a lot of abuse, etc., which was heaped on him. And it appears that some of those hostile posts were generated automatically by bots. So I guess that if you actually trace where these bots came from, it goes all the way to Russia. So basically, Putin wants this because, again, it tilts the balance a little bit, because you've got a Eurosceptic party which is in there and which is the kingmaker. And of course, it puts the other parties in a slightly more difficult position, because they don't want anything to do with this party, but they may well have to. And what sort of concessions will they have to make? Dealing with the devil, basically.
And it just fits that Putin narrative, doesn't it? Just trying to cause as much discord.
Absolutely.
As many
mischief making, breaking up alliances.
Now, why is there a story in one newspaper today about a Belgian weather forecaster?
Yes, this the lady in question, and please forgive my French, Cécile Junger. Now, she works for the French language public service broadcaster RTBF, and she has picked up 2.1 million Facebook views because of a comment that she made online or on her telephone. I mean, I don't know how half these things work, but anyway, she basically made some remarks about racism that she has experienced, because this lady is Belgium's only black television presenter. And she's very good at her job. She's not stupid. I mean, you know, it's not just telling us where the clouds are going to be and when the sun's coming out. There is a science. You know, she's a meteorologist. But while some people have welcomed her presence on Belgian TV, there are others who have been less than generous, shall we say. So she says, for example, when she made her posting, she said, if you want a good laugh, I've got a good one for you today. And somebody complained and said that she was too black and that all people could see were my clothes. And her colleague actually responded in a tongue-in-cheek way, and he said to the complainant, well, perhaps you could actually change the contrast on your TV, which is a great way of dealing with it. Now, she didn't really expect anything to come out of this, but she's picked up something like 2.1 million Facebook views, and she's triggered a debate, because people have said, look, it's absolutely outrageous that, you know, at the end of the day, this woman is doing her job. Let her do her job. But at the same time, Belgium is made up of many different groups of people. Why do we not have a diverse enough media that reflects the makeup of our nation? So there's some serious soul searching that this has provoked, even though she wasn't looking for it. She was just simply trying to show people, look, this is some of the rubbish which I have to take. And, you know, it's gone all the way up to the Prime Minister's office, and the academics have gone in on this. And so too has Juncker herself, because she's basically said, look, a lot of this stems from the fact that Belgium hasn't faced up to its past. Belgium has a colonial past. And what the article goes on to say is that in 1998, I'm sure you've probably come across this book, Adam Herxville wrote a book called King Leopold's Ghost. And it looked at the behaviour of the monarch, King Leopold II, because the Congo was part of Belgian territory. And basically, he turned it into his own fiefdom and committed the most disgusting atrocities against the people there. 15 million people died in the Congo Free State. There were people whose hands were cut off for minor pieces of misbehaviour, whatever. And it was really quite disgusting. And that book was a bit like throwing a grenade, taking out the pin and throwing a live grenade into a party. It forced Belgium to actually look at a part of its past, because you've got all these monuments to King Leopold, etc. But the point that she's making is that there is still not so much denial, but a fear of looking at the past. And really, this has actually forced people to confront the past in a different way. And there's quite a powerful quote in here because Cecile Djunga has said, "I'm not an activist. I'm not a spokesperson. I just want to live my life. I've had this since I was born. I think I am a strong person, but I am human. And this day it was too much. But I am pleased black people, but not just black people, are explaining their suffering. And we have to talk about this." So she's actually provoked a debate which she wasn't looking for.
It's absolutely extraordinary. I mean, it's all in that phrase at the beginning, isn't it? Belgium's only black television presenter, good Lord. We're out of time, I'm afraid, so we'll have to leave it there. But Juliet Foster, thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Well, finally on today's programme, London's Cinnamon Kitchen, which is marking its 10th anniversary with a very special event, inviting some of the best Indian chefs from across the capital to cook a feast for visitors. Well, Vivek Singh is the owner of Cinnamon Kitchen. He's joined me in the studio. Thank you for coming in this morning.
Thanks for having me.
Tell me a little more about how you're marking this anniversary.
Well, you know, when I think about it, the flagship Cinnamon Kitchen opened in November 2008. And at the time, it was just the worst time for our generation of people to be opening up a restaurant in the city. So who would have thought that we'd still be around after 10 years? But it's come around really quickly. We've had a lot of fun doing it. And it, in many ways, Cinnamon Kitchen did change people's perception of Indian food and Indian dining in this country. And it was doing things out in the open. The kitchen was much more interactive, using really good ingredients. And no longer did the magic need to happen behind closed doors. So it was actually, you know, doing all of that sort of stuff, real cooking in front of guests. And so to mark this event, we thought of inviting five of my sort of favorite Indian chefs who've kind of really in many ways shaped and changed the entire dining scene in London in the last 10 years or so. So we've got veterans like Cyrus Todiwala and Sriram Ayilur from Quilon. I'm delighted that they're participating. I'm cooking a few dishes too, as is Ravinder and Asma. Asma Khan from Darjeeling Express and Ravinder from Jikoni. So the two female chefs, you know, who 10 years ago you wouldn't have thought of, and really exciting restaurants. And I've got the young Turk in the form of Will Bowlby from Cricket. So it's a night like we've never had before, and it's a feast that awaits people on the 5th of November.
Now, you mentioned you opened so 10 out of 2008. I mean, that is in the pit of the global economic meltdown.
Absolutely.
Which presumably must have begun as you were sort of planning all of this.
So, yeah, I don't have the exact timeline on this, but I think, you know, it was probably, the restaurant opened a few weeks after the meltdown and the collapse of Lehman Brothers. So that puts things into context in terms of what was happening in the city at the time. It was really sort of, you know, the wrong timing, but in many ways, really so significant timing. Just goes to show that, you know, if you carry on doing things well and do it long enough and well enough, they do work out.
From a business perspective, what lessons have you learned in the last 10 years?
Well, you know, at the very least, I think, you know, that the biggest lesson has been that standing still isn't an option. There is no place for complacency or just sort of, you know, carrying on doing the same things. And people going out, people looking for experiences, people looking to try new ingredients, people are looking for new stories, people are looking to explore new things. And actually, you know, eating out, especially eating out Indian food, or in fact, eating out in London per se, is you know, you could travel the world without having to buy a plane ticket. I mean, there's so many restaurants, there's so many different dining experiences. Even the five or the six chefs that I mentioned, you know, the cooking styles are so different. The experiences, the inspiration, there's so much to discover. And I think that's something that's really come to the fore in the last 10 years.
That's the thing I want to talk about, because you said at the beginning there that these last 10 years, it partly has been about sort of reinventing the way people perceive Indian food. Now, look, Indian food is not a new thing in
Britain. No, not at all.
But there is a perception that it all sits in one box. And there is a box called Indian food. But actually, that's the same as saying British food is all one box. There are countless regions, there are countless changes and
so
different styles. And is that kind of the kind of thing that's come out more in the last 10
years? Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's something that's just come out so much that, you know, it's no longer... I take exception to this sort of term that we so loosely use, either calling things as curry or calling things as Indian food, because, you know, we don't use the term European food, you know, to describe the cuisine or cooking of the entire continent. In the same way, I mean, India has so many different influences, so many different traditions, regions, religions, an absolute mass of people and so many different influences. It's just not possible to box it into one generic term. And I think that's something that's, you know, become so obvious and so evident. The Darjeeling Express is the cooking of the Nawabs and the Mughal royal families is an expression of Asma's inheritance and, you know, in of her the growing up, as is Jikoni, which is Swahili for kitchen, tells a story of Indian food, but not necessarily just Indian food that is rooted in one tradition. It tells a story of Indian food that has traveled and is constantly in a state of flux. It's constantly absorbing new experiences, new inspirations, new ingredients, wherever it, in the world it may be. And then and of course there is a deep-rooted tradition of Parsi cooking from Cyrus's or Western coastal cooking from Sriram's. And so there is just so much more to discover. There is Rajasthani food, there is Bengali, there is North Indian tandoori, Mughal influences. It's just, there is so much to discover.
Just very quickly, of the various dishes that they're preparing, what's the one that you're most excited about trying?
And that's going to be a tough one. There's so much. There's a couple of classic game dishes that I'm cooking, but there's a samphire pakora. Who would have thought a samphire pakora with a date and tamarind chutney by Will Bowlby few years ago?
A bit peckish now. Vivek, we'll have to leave it there. Thank you very much for coming in. Those celebrations are on the 5th of November. That is it for this edition of Sunday Brunch, produced and studio managed by George McDonough. Our researcher was Megan Atkinson. News in just a moment, then it's Anna Calvey on the sessions of Midori House. A new Monocle Weekly is an hour away. For the moment, though, thanks so much for listening, and goodbye.